Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In today's episode, I'm joined by author of the books Let It Be and Dylan, Steve Matteo. Hello.
Hello, how are you, Chris?
I'm great. How's life in New York at the moment?
It's a beautiful day today. Blue suburban skies.
Must say, I'm loving your book, Act Naturally, The Beatles on Film. What was the what was the idea behind that?
Well, I knew someday I would probably do another book on the Beatles after doing the Let It Be book, which is mostly about the Let It Be album, but there is stuff in there about the film. And I, started kicking around the idea of, doing something on the films, because there really hasn't been a book in a while. I mean, there's been some really great books. You know, the Roy Carr book in particular, I think everybody really loves that book. So I ran into an editor in New York at Book Expo, which is the big book publishing convention. And this was in May of 2019. And so we're talking and he's like, what are you up to? And I said, I actually do have an idea for a book. And when I told him I thought it would be a good idea to do a book on the films of the Beatles, he was just immediately into the idea. So that was it. So I started working on the book before COVID. So once COVID hit and we were all in lockdown, it was sort of like, okay, I don't need to go anywhere. I mean, I had at the start of the project probably about 180 books on the Beatles. So I didn't really have to go anywhere to do research. And obviously in this day and age of everything being online, so that was really it. It was pretty simple. It's been a while. I mean, with all the new DVD and Blu-ray reissues of all the films and the reissues of the soundtrack albums on CD and vinyl, there was so much new material to be able to access.
Certainly. Perfect time to do it as well. Tell me, when did you first discover the Beatles? Can you remember?
I mean, I was a child in the 60s and we had AM radio. And so, the Beatles were just part of all of that sort of top 40, the Beatles, the Stones, Motown, the Mamas and the Papas, the Lovin' Spoonful. I mean, it's endless, all of this great music that was the most popular music of the day. And then as you get older, you start digging deeper into the albums. And you start getting more into it. And then they broke up. I won't say how old I was, but I was not a child anymore, but still not really an adult. But you don't realize the significance of it at the time. And then as time goes on, you just continue to get more into it as somebody who's really into music. And then I think when John Lennon died in 1980, everything sort of changes. It suddenly becomes something much deeper. And it just continues on. I mean, you start reading, there starts to be more books about the Beatles, more sort of in-depth books for many people. Nicholas Schaffner's book or Philip Norman's book become the first sort of big books that everybody's reading. And and it just builds over the years. There's so much that I feel like I know, but every time I do one of these books, I feel like it makes me realize that there's so much that I really don't know.
I feel your pain. And today we're talking about the made-for-TV film Magical Mystery Tour. So why are we still talking about this after all those years?
Well, I think, obviously, as you know, when Magical Mystery Tour first came out on Boxing Day in 1967 in black and white and was savaged by the critics and was met by bewilderment by people watching it, the day after Christmas, looking for, more sort of holiday fare. Over the years, I think the soundtrack album, everybody loved the music right away. And then the Capitol album in America, which became the official also UK album, it's just filled with so much great music. It collects some singles and EP tracks. And so it's a beloved album. And I think over the years, it's become something of a cult film. The midnight movies, the drive-in movies, whatever you want to call them, underground movies, it becomes significant in that regard. And I think that when people see the film in this sort of, as MTV is happening, they realize, oh, okay, I see now where videos come from, because it's very much, parts of it are sort of precursors to music videos. You know, there's sort of all these set pieces. It's this very loose sort of thing. I mean, it's a very psychedelic experience, Magical Mystery Tour. I think that, you know, I remember once a DJ did an interview with Jerry Garcia, and he asked Jerry, he said, so to appreciate the Grateful Dead, do you have to be high? And of course, you know, Jerry's, you know, gave this sort of yes and no answer. You know, I always, yeah, every time I see that clip and I hear the DJ ask the question, I always think the answer should be, well, it wouldn't hurt, you know. So, but it's part and parcel of the psychedelic culture and the year 1967, which is the ground zero of the psychedelic experience for people in terms of music and clothes. And, you know, London is the center of everything at that point. It's, I think San Francisco is just starting to emerge as part of the psychedelic scene. It's moving from London to San Francisco. So it's an important film, and those songs on that soundtrack album are so significant too. You know, Sgt. Pepper, Magical Mystery Tour, and even Yellow Submarine to some degree are sort of the center of it all. So I think people watch the film now and I think they get a lot more out of it, you know, especially if they're open-minded. I'll just say that. And so, I mean, I obviously, because I wrote the book, I watched it again, and I just loved it. I mean, it's like I'm seeing, every time I see it, I think I see it again anew through, you know, yeah, kaleidoscope eyes, you know?
So, I mean, the idea came in April 67, and Paul and Mal were in Denver for Jane Asher's birthday, and Paul had the idea, and in Mal's diary entry on 7th of April, he mentioned the excitement about planning the television film, which they envisioned as a mystery tour. And on 11th of April, flying back to London, Paul worked on the first lyrics for the Magical Mystery Tour, and here we get the story about the circle on a pad of paper. Eventually the Beatles would fill in all the other bits. But I think the events from here on, there are a few things that happened that had an impact, delayed it, and in some sense pushed them towards doing it.
I mean, obviously at this time in April of 67, Brian is still alive. So if Brian had continued to live and remained in the capacity as their manager, because don't forget, I believe it was in August or September when the official contract was going to end. And, you know, I talk about this in the book, that there's conflicting sort of points of view of some people say, well, no, the Beatles wouldn't have fired Brian. Some people say, oh, yes, they were definitely going to fire Brian. I mean, I think Brian's role had already changed and was going to continue to change. I think, you know, what Brian did the most was launch them, you know, into the world. And then I think his day-to-day was very much what was involved with touring and television appearances and just being there to facilitate things for them. So once Brian has passed away and they decide to make this film, it changes on a sort of aesthetic level, but I think it also changes on a very practical level, because suddenly now there isn't Brian to take care of all the little details, booking hotels and booking coaches and making sure everybody's fed lunch and just things like that. So suddenly now the Beatles are sort of having to figure out a lot of this stuff themselves. I mean, I think that Neil Aspinall and Mal Evans are already facilitating some of this stuff and taking care of it. But I think with Brian, it was done on a much higher level with a much larger staff from NEMS. Would Brian have, you know, maybe corral them a little bit more into making something that was a bit more coherent, maybe was a bit more commercial? Maybe would Brian have said, well, gee, you know, maybe we shouldn't have this released initially on television on the day after Christmas. Everybody's watching it on their little black and white TVs the size of, you know, laptops. I mean, it was broadcast in color not too long after the initial black and white broadcast, as you know. So I think when people saw it on color, I think there was a certain amount of people who said, oh, okay, I think I kind of get this. Or, you know, there were some people who were already open-minded enough to sort of get what it was about. You know, it's hard for us now to see it and look at it as something that's so weird and bizarre, you know, because we've seen weird and bizarre for 50 years, you know.
Exactly. I think when you go back to Brian, you know, how he lived, the organization, I mean, the disorganization of this is astonishing in terms of the accommodation for the extras. It's pretty chaotic. I think they're all given £5 to cover food for the week, which today would be the equivalent of £116. And you hear stories about fan club secretaries sleeping on the floor. One time, Jenny Crowley woke up in the bath. I think Brian would have definitely made things easier for the crew and the cast.
I mean, would that have changed the film? I mean, I really don't know. You know, it was the 60s. And I think one of the reasons why we are still here talking about the music and films and art and culture of that time is I think that everything was brand new. There was this sense of, you know, let's just try this and see what happens. You know, I mean, so much of the Beatles recordings, once they got to, say, Rubber Soul, Revolver, so much of it was John or Paul saying to George Martin, oh, could we try this? And I think that sense of open-mindedness and experimentation and doing things that hadn't been done before is what made so much of what happened back then, you know, so great. Now everything is filtered through focus groups and fear and, you know, is it going to be commercial? Are the critics going to like it? Everything has been done. Rock and roll is, what did Joe Strummer say, 3 chords and the truth or something like that? I mean, it's a limited artistic form in many ways, rock and roll. But in the 60s and obviously into the 70s, and maybe beyond to some degree, people took it in all these directions and tried different things and said, let's mix this with that. There isn't a lot of mixing of genres and things that go on today in music. And, you know, I'll put you on the spot. You know, name me one new group that's come up in the last 5 years. A group, not a solo artist, but a group that is really made people, you know, sit up and take notice. I think that's one of the things we're missing in music these days, too. You'd get a group with John, Paul, and George in it. You know, you get a group like the Rolling Stones with Brian and Mick and Keith and the great Charlie Watts. The Byrds. I mean, think of the Byrds. You've got Roger McGuinn, David Crosby, Chris Hillman, and Gene Clarke in one group, you know? I mean, that is just ridiculous. And so I know I'm getting off a little bit on a tangent here, but I think that makes Magical Mystery Tour so interesting is the sense of they just did it and they didn't think about it too much.
There's some interesting context here because Mal Evans wrote, on Thursday, 24th of August, only a few days before he died, Brian had a long chat with John, Paul, George and Ringo, and everybody talked about things to be done for the rest of the year. Brian was very enthusiastic about Magical Mystery Tour and wanted us to go ahead right away with filming the show. It goes without saying that Brian's death caused confusion of thought amongst all of us. At first, the majority agreed that it would be best to take a good long break, accept Maharishi's invitation to spend 2 or 3 months with him in India, and shelve all other plans until afterwards. But as the days went by, everybody began to realise that it made much more sense to go ahead with Magical Mystery Tour, take a break after the production was completed. On Friday the 1st of September, there was a general conference, get-together at Paul's house, while everybody added ideas. So I spoke to Jenny Boyd recently, who was saying the Maharishi, she wasn't that convinced with his solution, oh, don't worry about it, just keep meditating. She didn't think that they had a chance to grieve. So they have plunged straight into this.
You know, that's interesting, and it makes me think, and maybe I didn't think about this as This is one of the 1 million things that is not in my book, is after Sergeant Pepper and after Brian dies, they dive right into Magical Mystery Tour. And then after the White Album, they dive right into Let It Be. And so maybe those are the two projects that have been the most savaged by the critics.
Yeah.
But I think, I guess maybe I thought about it, but I don't know if I get into this. I don't think I get into this in my book. But I think there was a sense that Paul felt that if they didn't do something right away, that they could lose the group, that there could be a sense that they could lose the group. So, I mean, who knows? Paul liked to work. I think the others would enjoy a little bit more downtime. And, you know, they did owe another movie to United Artists. So maybe there was a sense, too, in the back of their minds that this is a way to fulfill that contract and be done with this. That's another thing that's never really been, as much research as I did, that's never been really resolved.
I think some of the suggestions were probably best that they didn't go with, to be fair.
When a man buys a ticket for a Magical Mystery Tour, he knows what to expect. We guarantee him the trip of a lifetime, and that's just what he gets. The Incredible Magical Mystery Tour.
I'd like to go through the film with you, actually, but I think just to start off, first day gives a pretty good insight into how chaotic it was. So it's Monday, 11th of September, 1967, Allsop Place, opposite Baker Street Underground in London. Everybody's waiting for the bus to arrive. Paul's sitting on the pavement next to Ivor Cutler, surrounded by suitcases. The bus should have arrived at 10:45, but it was 2 hours late because it was still being painted and having all the designs put on. Once on board, the coach headed off to Surrey to pick up John, George and Ringo. But one key thing, everybody who'd arrived there was all these suitcases, but they were told for continuity purposes they had to wear the same clothes for the duration of the filming. And we'd seen the footage, all the cigarettes and brown ale, that coach must have absolutely honked. And as for this disorganised go with the flow attitude of filming, yeah, as I say about the accommodation, that wasn't great. It's very much, you know, they were making it up as they were going along. But Paul particularly had the confidence of, yeah, we can do anything. And they'd just done Pepper.
Yeah. You know, again, I think it was part of the charm and the appeal of it. And I think for them was to just, let's not think about this so much. Let's see what happens and just kind of take it from there. It's very cinema verite. It's very like, you know, documentary. It's very like, you know, let's not make it so organized. I mean, I think that's a lot of what, like I said before, I think that's a lot of what the 60s was, is this sense of just, let's do it. Let's not think about it too much. Let's see what happens. Let's have some happy accidents. You know, so I think that was kind of part of it for them. And, you know, again, obviously, initially, it didn't work very good, but in terms of how it was perceived. But I think, again, over the years, you look back at it now, it becomes one of those kind of key 60s cult films, underground films, that is significant and influential going forward in terms of film, you know, in general, in the 60s and the 70s.
So let's go to the film. So during the opening credits, we get the song Magical Mystery Tour with John's brilliant, "When a man buys a ticket for a Magical Mystery Tour, he knows what to expect." And I love the scene where you see Ringo buying the ticket, the shop in Westmoreland. And Stanley Brown, who actually owns the shop, has got some memories of that. And he said apparently the Beatles approached him to see if they could film there because on a Friday, that was his busiest period. So he said, you're going to have to wait until I've closed. So they went back and he said, "It was quite a day for my 8-year-old daughter, Penny. She was able to chat to the boys and even helped John put his false moustache straight for one shot. Then all three signed a photograph of John's flowered Rolls Royce. It made a dream day for her. They made a very good impression on me. They were very polite and left the shop as they found it. Payment? I forgot to ask. But as they packed up to leave, somebody handed me a fiver to buy myself a drink. And when we checked the takings at the end of the day, we were 30 bob better off than their tour ticket money." It's lovely that so many people were involved and still have these memories of it. It must have just been the Beatles on a coach with, you know, all these people on board turning up at places. I mean, they were definitely hounded by the press.
You know, one of the things that I pointed out in the book is when you see sort of like outtakes or you see photographs, there's a lot of people just hanging around and the Beatles interacting with them like casually. So that is amazing, because don't forget, they were still at that point where if they were spotted anywhere, say like London, I mean, they're going to be hounded. Okay. People are going to still chase them down the street. So to be able to be in this kind of casual environment where somebody could just say, oh, hi, George, and just start talking.
Yeah.
You know, I think they were relaxed enough. It was almost like they were on holiday. You know what I mean? You know, it's as we keep talking about how underground and avant-garde and wild it is, but it also is very much a throwback to the let's put on a show. Let's just jump on the coach and go on holiday and see what happens. Yeah. It's like one of my favorite writers is Tom Wolfe, not Thomas Wolfe, Tom Wolfe. I like Thomas Wolfe too. And Tom Wolfe, he's mostly known as a nonfiction writer, his narrative nonfiction, new journalism in the 60s. But he did write novels later on in life. And he said about writing fiction is that what he would do is he wouldn't start with a story or characters, is he would start with the setting, the place, and then see who walks through the door. And that's almost kind of what the Beatles sort of did with Magical Mystery Tour. It's like, okay, so we'll create this loose framework and then we'll just kind of see what happens. And that might be more fun to do it that way.
Absolutely.
Richard B. Starkey and his Aunt Jessica are always arguing about one thing or another.
Oh, I'm going.
Oh, go! Go on.
And what with today being Sunday and the weather looking up, you'd think they'd have given it a rest.
For goodness sake, will you stop that sitting down?
All right, what's your hurry?
But no, on and on they go.
So one of the last scenes to be filmed on 29th of October is the actual opening, and that's Ringo and Aunt Jessie arguing. I get the impression the Beatles have realised that they've forgotten to film an opening sequence. So they headed off to Battersea for the very first scene. You see him walking up Acanthus Road. But the string chemistry between Ringo and Jessie Robbins is fantastic.
You know, there are so many of these people who are in the films, the first three films. You know, Let It Be, there's cameos of people being themselves. But I mean, if you look at the people, the actors and actresses who are in the first three films, they're extraordinary people who have amazing careers that some of them lasted for decades. And while maybe us here in the United States, maybe we don't know who these people are as much, the people in England, these are household names. These are people that are just beloved figures. So their place in British film or television history is significant. But for many, it's seeing them in a Beatles film is such a big deal. You know, Richard Lester has always said, when I pass, no matter all the films that I did, the headline is going to be Beatles director Richard Lester.
Yes.
That's what everybody's going to remember more than anything else. There's nothing you can do on this planet than do something with the Beatles. I mean, there are so many people who worked on the Beatle films, who worked on the Harry Potter films, who worked on the Lord of the Rings films. And it's like, yeah, that's great, but they worked with the Beatles. And so that's the thing, no matter what, that is the thing that people like want to know about. It's short of the guys, you know, from the Renaissance, you know, Da Vinci and those guys. You've heard of them, right? The Beatles are probably the most famous people that have ever lived. It is a phenomenon that we will never see again. So, yeah, the chemistry. Paul has always said that Ringo would have been a star anyway, even if he wasn't in the Beatles. He was gonna be a movie star. He was gonna be somebody. He was gonna be Ringo, you know. So he is wonderful. You can't take his eyes off.
He really shines in this film. Jessie Robbins. There's going to be some references soon. You won't have a clue. So, but yeah, Jessie Robbins, previously uncredited in Billy Liar, also later in Ken Loach's Up the Junction.
You ever seen one of them urns? You'd never think they'd get me in one of them, would you?
And one for John Higgs, another James Bond connection, a pastry cook in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which I particularly enjoyed. Yeah, so we move on. They're greeted by Jolly Jimmy Johnson.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome to Magical Mystery Tour.
And Miss Wendy Winters.
Good morning, lads and lasses. My name is Miss Winters.
Good morning, Miss Winters, Miss Winters, Miss Winters.
And this is Derek Royal, who plays Jolly Jimmy, and Mandy Wheat, a.k.a. Miranda Forbes. And Jolly Jim... Jolly Jimmy is probably best known in the UK for the 40 Towers episode, The Kipper and the Corpse, where he was the corpse that Basil has to sneak out the hotel. But he'd also later have roles in LOLO, which was a Perry and Croft sitcom in the UK, Shine on Harvey Moon, which is a very well-respected play, Benny Hill Show, and a cop show we had in the 80s, I think it was Juliet Bravo. Mandy Wheat, again, her real name, Miranda Forbes. Yeah, she died very young in 2001. She later played a traffic warden on Brush Strokes, which was a kind of okay comedy, again, sort of early 80s. Miss Hessop in Press Gang. Now, Press Gang was a huge thing over it. If you were about 12 to 15, Press Gang was a kids' program about kids running a publishing company, and it was just superb. Huh? She was in that. But she also had roles in Absolutely Fabulous, Coronation Street, as Beryl Chalice. Again, this will mean nothing to you.
A lot of this stuff I do know.
Ah, brilliant. Right, well, Derek Hilton, famously Mavis Riley's partner, Derek was originally going out with Beryl Chalice beforehand, and she basically dumped him after realising he was having an affair with Mavis.
Oh, I'm a silly man sometimes.
Oh, no, you're not.
Yes, I am.
Oh, Daddy.
Yeah, and also, like Derek Royal, she also appeared in Shine on Harvey Moon. You also get to see Alf Manders, the driver, and there's a lovely scene at the beginning of the film where you see them all saluting, and Alf just looks really uncomfortable. He's obviously just there to do the driving. Come and get in front of the camera. He's not happy. And some of the extras in here, so we've got the Beatles fan club secretaries, Frida Kelly, Sylvia Nightingale, Barbara King and Jenny Crowley. Originally, before they started filming, Frida was up in Liverpool sorting through the latest mountain of mail from fan club members, and Tony Barrow apparently approached her and said, would you like to join them on the bus? And she only had three extra spaces, so she just got people who were local and who were available. So, yeah, what a thing to go to.
Anyway, I'll tell you something. You ain't coming away with me anymore.
Who bought the tickets for this trip? I did.
Yeah, with my money.
I bought them.
I gave you the money.
I'm taking you out. Yeah, you're not taking me anywhere.
I gave you the money,
remember,
darling.
That? And you've done nothing but eye all the fellas on the coach since we got here.
Shut your mouth.
I don't know. Since Uncle Jack died, you've never been the same.
Well, of course I ain't, because I ain't got Uncle Jack, have I?
Well,
so I've
got to
get somebody
him.
Else, haven't I?
I remember him.
If I ain't got to get him, I've got to get somebody else, haven't I?
No, I don't know.
You should
Loving
know.
Your
you're
age.
Old enough at 21.
Should do a bit of knitting, do you good.
Who for? You? Should I knit for you?
No, don't knit for me.
On the bus, Ringo and Jesse, no, don't knit for me, which I think is, you can see originally when they're walking along the street, you think, oh, it's kind of scripted, they kind of know what they're doing, but now it's immediately obvious it's ad-libbed, but yep. They're the best two.
Yes, definitely. You know, I mean, that's a lot of what makes it is this, they're quick-witted people. So to allow for a lot of improvisation is going to work rather than reading from some stilted script that maybe they're not comfortable with. Don't forget, too, they filmed dozens and dozens of hours of filmmaking, and then they boiled it down to roughly 45 minutes. So the rushes were probably truly insane. But you know, one of the most amazing scenes is there's a scene when they're driving. It's like a road race.
Oh.
And I think it's Ringo is driving one of the buses.
Yeah.
And if you know, watching it now, I'm watching it going, that looks dangerous. you're really risking the life of the most famous drummer in music history by doing that. Would never happen today.
No.
That would never happen.
And
he would
passengers.
Not they would not allow him to do that. I mean, it's insane.
Well, I think he's hanging out the window, isn't he? And it's almost going on two wheels.
I believe it is. Yeah, right. I mean, it's like, it's not something I was really conscious of until this most recent time that I watched it. It was just like, oh my God. It's like, really?
Terrible.
I mean, they were young too. They were in their 20s. It was the 60s. It was like, you know, it's like another planet.
It's on a parallel universe. If that bus had crashed, you know, and it could have happened. It was going at a hell of a speed.
Thank God it didn't.
Yeah.
Who is that man?
Oh, that's Mr. Bloodvessel. He's quite harmless. He comes on all the trips. He thinks he's a courier.
1, 2, 3.
I saw an elephant at the bus stop, leaning on a young man's leg and singing cock-a-doodle-doo. I threw my little yellow shoe. He started singing cock-a-doodle-dum, ba-dum, 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 dum.
1, 2, 3.
I saw my granny at the pictures, biting all the buttons off the seats and singing cock-a-doodle-doo. I threw my little yellow shoe. She started singing cock-a-doodle-dum, ba-dum, 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 dum.
Then we meet Buster Bloodvessel, who's played by much loved and highly respected poet Ivor Cutler. Beatles obviously knew him from Late Night Lineup. He'd obviously be playing his harmonium. Following his appearance in this, he recorded an album called Ludo, which was produced by George Martin. But I think this is a very canny bit of casting.
Yes. I mean, he's one of those people who, and again, it's interesting that he already has the connection with the Beatles, because, and I mentioned this in the book, as you said, that album was produced by George Martin. So, I mean, he's one of these interesting figures. I think people in America don't necessarily know who he is, but he is one of these sort of interesting, not to overuse the word, but somewhat underground figure, a literary man, really, if you think about it, a poet and a musician. I mean, he's this really incredible figure. He plays this kind of strange character in the film, but he is a cool person to have in your movie. There's no question about it. I think that was Paul. That was Paul's idea to have him in the film.
Well, he was, when they were waiting for the bus to arrive, that was him and Paul just sitting next to each other, and apparently they were chatting for ages.
Yeah.
He's amazing. I love Ivor Cutler.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes?
I'd like to take a photograph of the young lady. Do you mind?
Don't mind if Miss Gabriella does.
I'll take it while you're there.
Well, Miss Gabriella does.
You don't.
Sorry, don't
mind. Bye-bye. See you later, maybe.
Come along.
Well, we won't see you later. Can I have you out here?
All right.
Lucky day.
Then we meet George Claydon, who's sitting next to Nat Jackley, and he asks to take the photo of the starlet. George Claydon, who plays Little George, as they call him, he was the actual 1966 World Cup Willy mascot, so basically dressed up as a lion. You can see him do that later during the photograph scene. Later played an Oompa Loompa in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, as well as appearing in the Ringo Starr T-Rex movie Born to Boogie. Another tenuous link, Lonnie Donegan released a single on the back of the 1966 World Cup called World Cup Willy.
Dressed in red, white and blue, he's World Cup Willy. We all love him too. World Cup Willy, he's tough as a lion.
Nat Jackley, Happy Nat the Rubber Man. His career started in the 1920s. He was a traditional variety entertainer in Music Hall from 1955.
They bung me into kilts and all the draft made me feel blue. Don't know where it came from, but I know where it was going to.
Later life, he took on a lot more character roles. He was another one who had a role in Juliet Bravo. He was also in Minder and even the TV show, which was huge in the UK in the 80s, Threads, about the nuclear war. So yeah, he was in that. And Maggie Wright, obviously the starlet, and she was a starlet, she'd been in What's New Pussycat, Goldfinger, I think she was uncredited in that, and four episodes of The Saint. So at the time, like you say, people will know, oh look, it's him, it's her, they will all know who they were.
These movies that you're mentioning, the actor that was in, imagine you're an actor and you say, well, I was in Willy Wonka and Magical Mystery Tour. Okay.
Yes.
I mean, he should be knighted for that, I mean, it's like, and I mean, you're mentioning, The Saint and, What's New Pussycat.
Yeah.
It's like these movies would never be made today. Mm. People would just, these films are sort of, on the one hand, there's something very sort of innocent about them. They're really not X-rated at all, or they're really not underground or counterculture. But they're also, there's this kind of wink-wink sort of hilarity to them. It's such incredible style. These films have such amazing style.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him. They can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round.
So after we've met the cast, then we go to Fool on the Hill, and this was the penultimate scene to be filmed on 30th of October. Where Paul minus his passport and cameraman Aubrey Dewar flew to Nice. And again, this is very, in Beatles lore, it's kind of, oh look, Paul's gone off and done his own thing. But they had actually finished most of the film. They were now editing it and they thought, we do need another bit. Though having said that, Peter Brown said that none of the other Beatles knew that he had gone.
You know, it's like, it's interesting when you sort of like, if you're isolating different things, it's like, I always feel like when I watch Magical Mystery Tour, it becomes like this whole just, it's a trip. It really is. And it's sort of like, you just kind of go through it and it's like, wait a minute, what did I just see? It's like, What happened? I don't know. You're waiting. There's supposed to be some kind of like, what happens at the end? You know? Yeah. So it's like, I think there are scenes that in my mind, I kind of always remember. The scene with John when he's shoveling the spaghetti is like, that scene is just like unbelievable. I mean, it really is kind of incredible. Yeah. It's so visceral. The sort of the scenes with Ivor Cutler are, they're subtle, but then you think about them later. Yeah. There's a sense of you kind of thinking about them later. The scene at the review bar. That scene would almost never be in a movie these days because people would either say, who cares? Or it would be like, well, that's completely politically incorrect. Yeah. But there is, it's almost out of character, that scene.
It is. On the bus, we see Frida Kelly and Magic Alex. He's there. And there's a lovely outtake with him as well.
You may talk about the King of Gideon. You may talk about the King of Soul. That is all I good old Joe's away on the back of Jericho. One more angel, just in the back of Jericho. Jericho, Jericho. Just in the back of Jericho. I'm a ghost and tumbling.
It's funny how there's people who are like, you know, oh, he's this guy, he was this bloodsucker, and he did all these horrible things, and he didn't know what he was doing. But there was a lot of people that I've read interviews with and stuff, and they said that he was very smart. And for whatever reason, John really took to him. There was some kind of connection there. I mean, he was in there. He was a key guy in their world for a number of years. So there must have been something to it. It's interesting that we've never really heard from him ever again. Like, he didn't write a book.
There's very little information about him. I know someone who's going to do a book about him, but there's not a lot
really?
Out there. Yeah.
Okay.
But we shall find out. Yeah, and then there's a little random bit. They're just sort of standing around and sitting on the bus, and they're filming all the different passengers, and you've got the guys swallowing the cigarette, and then, disgusting. But you've got the music is The Bus, which was originally the end of Flying, the full version of Flying, that sort of psychedelic swirly bit at the end. And it's just I find this a lovely part of the film. It's just a very eerie moment, and then you get the bus driving by, and Neil Aspinall just appears. He's standing by the trees. But yeah, then we get
your bloody car!
Victor Spinetti as Sergeant Spinetti. And he's certainly the best actor, I think, so far. We've seen.
Yeah, the Beatles loved him. I mean, they wanted him in every film, and he's one of these people, you know, he's another one who just, his career continued on for years. I believe that he's in the Prince film, Under the Cherry Moon. He's in one of the films about the craze. So, you know, he kept on doing things and making movies and theater, and he's one of these sort of really beloved figures. And I mean, he makes some of those movies. Some of the best scenes, you know, in the films are him. I mean, his scene playing the deranged sergeant is just, the wordplay is insane.
He based it because he previously done this role in Oh, What a Lovely War, a stage play. But he's so good. He worked, obviously, as you know, with John the following year with the adaptation of In His Own Right. and also appeared in the London Town video by Wings.
Right.
Sort of mime. Yeah, and again, lots of people have said it before, but the comparisons, well, it wasn't out yet, but Monty Python, especially that scene with the cow in the field and the desk in the fields, you can see Monty Python when we're watching this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that point that you just brought out is really important. I mean, the Monty Python folks were already around in different ways at this time. They were already doing things. They just weren't, you know, Monty Python's Flying Circus yet. But, you know, the various people were involved in, you know, whether it was movies or especially television shows, the different sort of satirical television shows that were around. Yeah, I mean, Magical Mystery Tour, there's parts of it that are definitely, you can watch episodes of Monty Python's Flying Circus, Fawlty Towers. There's no question about it. Life of Brian. It's all the same sort of humor. You know, there's no question about it.
Yeah.
The Goons. I mean, it's all connected. The Beatles are part of it. You know, and musical groups like the Bonzos. I mean, there's no question about it, who are in the film.
Then we get probably my least favorite part of the film, the Magical Mystery Tour Marathon, which we were talking about before. This was filmed at Westmorling on Saturday, the 23rd of September. And as you said, yeah, Ringo. I think Ringo said he really enjoyed driving the bus. But, I mean, looking at it, I'd be absolutely terrified being in that. And you've got Mal leaping in the boots. It just looks so dangerous. And then I think it's John and George in the Mini, when they've done the dialogue replacement over the top. You can just hear them both going, it's just quite surreal. And the music is a brass version of She Loves You. It comes from Irvine's 89-key merengue, Fair Organ Plays Lennon and McCartney, which was a Decca EP from 1965, as well as the Zampa Overture by the GUS Brackets Footwear Band and Stanley Boddington, which was available on the Reader's Digest album The Best of Brass. So if you want to compile your own song track, there you go, they're the songs you need. And again, yeah, we get George Claydon taking the photo, and that's where we see in the lion head, which was the World Cup mascot. And then, yeah, the famous bit where Jolly Jimmy's saying, if you look to your left, ladies and gentlemen.
Gentlemen, the view is not very inspiring. Ah, but if you look to your right.
A lot of people have cited as the reason it didn't work in black and white, but what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I love the song Flying. I love the sequence. I guess Flying is the only Beatles song that all four of them share songwriting credits. It's a shame they almost didn't do more stuff like that, just to show you like what they could do. And, you know, you mentioning some of this sort of incidental music or soundtrack music or whatever. When they did the Magical Mystery Tour box set a few years ago for the film, the one that has the EP in it, it's got the film on Blu-ray and DVD and some other goodies, they really should have included all of the incidental music. I really think that they should have done that. Now, I know, obviously, with like Yellow Submarine, they did the Yellow Submarine song track. That was different. It was just including all the Beatles songs, basically. But that was a missed opportunity, I think. You know, maybe, who knows, maybe this is stuff that will come out eventually. I had a chance to, when Giles Martin did his little introduction for the press in New York of Revolver reissue last September, I was able to go, which was great. And I got to meet Giles, which was, you know, really cool. And they're now, I would think the next thing they're going to do is Rubber Soul. But they haven't done a Giles Martin reissue of A Hard Day's Night, of Help, of Magical Mystery Tour. Now, okay, they They did do Let It Be. They haven't done Yellow Submarine. So there's still more Let It Be stuff. They did the film of just The Rooftop where they showed it in movie theaters, yeah, in IMAX. And the soundtrack for that was only issued on streaming.
Yes.
So Giles, if you're listening, that sounds like a great box set. All of the film music and then all of the incidental film music that hasn't come out. I mean, the real music album, people really don't like. That, you know, it's a horrible cover, and it's just, you know, selections from some of the songs. I talk about it in the book, and there's some things that I actually like about it. Mm. But imagine a box set of all the soundtrack albums and a lot of extras.
I'd buy that.
That would be something else.
Definitely, yeah. Another one is Shirley's Wild Accordion.
I was going to mention that, yes.
It is on the Blu-ray, but you have to pretty well hunt around to find it.
And right, you can expect, but it isn't. It isn't. You can do that, but it isn't like part of a vinyl album or a CD or something like that. Which is that particular track. And you know, it's interesting you brought that up, because I went back and I said, wait a minute, did I write about that? Is that in the book? And is that on the Magical Mystery Tour reissue? And I'm like hunting all over the. And I'm like, no, I thought it was. And so that was an important thing. Like, that should be something that's available as an audio piece.
I think people have extracted it and put it online, but it's still not the full version. If you look at Mark Lewisohn's notes, you've got John and Paul, I think it is, whooping all over it, and you can hear them all.
Right.
Ringo's on there as well. But this is just purely the accordion. So, why didn't they? You know, just that's the way to have this. Don't make us buy loads of stuff. Just put it on a box set. I quite like that it was hidden away, that you had to sort of dig out for it. That's what the fans love doing. If you're going to do it, do the whole thing with the Beatles on. You know, it's a legendary song.
Well, maybe they will. I mean, Magical Mystery Tour has been reissued as a movie box set, but not as a audio box set.
Yes. Don't hold your breath.
I'm right. You never know.
Yeah.
Beyond the blue horizon, far above the clouds, in a land that no one knows, live four or five magicians who spend their days casting wonderful spells. Come with me now into that secret place where the eyes of man have never set foot.
And we get to meet the magicians. This is filmed on the 20th of September at Westmorland. And Mal is included as well, which I think is fantastic. And everybody watching would have known who he was as well. I love that.
I mean, they finally get to play wizards. I mean, they wanted to do Lord of the Rings. So, you know, here's their opportunity to be wizards. I particularly love that sequence. There is something about the style of many parts of the film, particularly that there is something interesting about it. It is unique. It does give you that psychedelic feeling. It is very much whimsical, you know, yet heavy. Too, in a way, you know, it is well done. I love that sequence.
My dear lady, doesn't intuition tell you what I feel? Don't interrupt. You bring out my. I love you.
Buster Bloodvessel declares his love for Aunt Jessie, and this was filmed on Wednesday the 13th of September. They'd headed off to Watergate Bay and Tregurian Beach in Newquay, where they filmed Jessie Robbins and Ivor Cutler having their romantic walk. Strangely, this, on the night it was broadcast, on Boxing Day 1967, this was actually cut from the original screening, because the BBC deemed it unsuitable. I have no idea why. Why?
I don't know. Yeah, because of their ages or something, or because there was something weird about it. Who knows? And that's a long time ago. The BBC is notorious for censorship back then, you know.
Yeah. What I don't understand is that they cut that, but they didn't cut the stripper scene. So I'm getting the impression that somebody from the BBC, I know they only had a cursory look, and I think
maybe they didn't see it. Right.
Bizarre. And the beautiful, again, if you want to do your own compilation, The Orchestra All My Loving was from a 1965 EP by Arthur Wilkinson and his orchestra called Beetle Cracker Ballet. and it is lovely. That, I think this is one of those beautiful scenes in it with the music. It is genuinely romantic.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't have been cut. You know, I mean, I think the newer versions, obviously, it's restored.
Yeah.
I am the courier. Good morning, men and women. Welcome. I am your friendly courier. Mr. Bloodvessel is my name. Buster Bloodvessel. I am concerned for you to enjoy yourselves within the limits of British decency. You know what I mean, don't you? Well, don't you?
Yes, Mr. Bloodvessel.
And it's a quick cut back to the bus where Buster is now the courier. Another great line, I'm concerned for you to enjoy yourself within the limits of British decency. Straight into incredible footage. West morning again. John's eyes rolling to the back of his head. I am the walrus.
I am he as you are.
You know, it's so obvious as we're sitting here and we're talking about it, you realize that this really is a good film. It really is entertaining. I mean, it really, and it's funny, it's touching, it's got great music. I think too that there's probably things that are in it that, you know, we think were so cool, but there's things that we've all probably missed through the years. It would be interesting to sit Paul down and interview him just about Magical Mystery Tour and ask him that question. Was there anything that we've all missed in Magical Mystery Tour? And he'd probably laugh and say, you mean like only one thing?
Yeah.
you know what I'm saying? And they would always put these little, I mean, the whole roll up, roll up. I mean, he said it was obvious we were talking about rolling joints. He wasn't hiding that. You didn't have to be too smart to figure that out. And he said those were the kind of little things they would put in for their friends. So there's many little touches that we're probably, even in this late part of the game, we're still missing.
Yeah. But I think he said as well, isn't it, you know, just watch the film. If you don't like it, just watch it for this. It's the Beatles performing I'm the Walrus. And
right.
Again, we talked about it recently. In 1979, they showed all the films at Christmas on the BBC in the UK. And that's the first time I'd really seen them. I'd heard the music. I was still a kid. And I'd heard I'm the Walrus, you know, it blows your head off as a kid, you know, because your imagination is so much more vivid. But to see it, I was literally, my brain exploded. There was John. Because I think I had the Red and the Blue albums at that age. So I thought from 67 onwards, they looked like they did on the cover for three years or whatever. And
right.
I thought, wow, he hasn't got a moustache. He's not wearing his glasses. And he's singing I Am the Walrus. And it was a genuinely powerful moment. What a performance as well. Oh, yes. And as the song fades out in the film, it's interspersed with footage of people eating fish and chips, obviously. And this was filmed on the 15th of September en route to Taunton, where they stopped off at Amy Medley's fish and chip shop. And there's a lovely newspaper article from the time, and it says, it all came out as a result of a chat Mrs. Smedley had with the famous Fallen Newquay. Mrs. Smedley was on holiday where she took part as an extra in the television film the Beatles are making. In the course of chatting with them, she mentioned that she and her husband had a fish and chip shop in Taunton. On Friday morning, she had a telephone call to say the Beatles would be arriving later. And Nicola Hale, as in Little Nicola, was actually the granddaughter of Amy Smedley, the owner of the chip shop.
I've got a present for you. Do you know what it is?
No.
Have a guess.
No.
Go on, have a guess.
No.
Have a guess.
No.
Have a guess.
No.
It's here we see the five little dicky birds sitting on your head with John and George and little Nicola. And this is just adorable. And you get to see John, probably what he would have been like as a dad in the 60s.
Yeah. I know. This very sort of counterculture, psychedelic, weird movie, there are a lot of moments of real affection and kindness, and we get to see this kind of other side. I think the fact that they're in this spontaneity where things just happen, they're not the cool Beatles, which is great. You get to see there's so much of still at that point of like, you know, well, Paul's the cute one and John's the, you know, the sarcastic one and George is the quiet one. And well, no, they're not two-dimensional figures. They're human beings with many different sides. And so you get to see these moments that I think give you a much more well-rounded kind of view of who they are. You know, I don't think there's any question about it. John used to always say to Paul, like, Paul is kind of the natural dad. He just, in real life, you know what I'm saying? And John sometimes struggled with it. And he would say to Paul, you know, how do you do it? You just seem to be able to do it so naturally. It's so much harder for me. I think later in life with Sean, I think, you know, for John, he grew into it and he grew up and matured and learned and was there for Sean.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see that scene in retrospect.
When you say it like that, it's almost like this film is the perfect sandwich between Help and Let It Be, because it is a film, it's got a plot and it's got cast, but there's scenes where they are just being themselves, such as this. So you've got John.
Right.
This is kind of like he is with the little Heather in Let It
Be. Right.
And it's just a lovely little moment. And I think he's great with kids. He's got that real kind of at their level, you know, kind of humor. I think it's adorable.
Yeah, he's a lot of his work is very childlike. It is influenced a lot by, you know, the way that a child thinks or children's literature, or, you know, he had a difficult childhood. You know, there's no question about it. So this is what's great about being able to see things over and over again. I was doing an interview and somebody said back in the day, a movie would come out, it would play for a certain amount of time, and then you wouldn't see it again. There was no streaming, no DVDs, no Blu-rays. Yeah, eventually it would come on television. But now I can just go take the Magical Mystery Tour Blu-ray and put it in my Blu-ray player and I could just watch it anytime I want. And every time you watch a film like this that is so out there, you discover new things and there's new layers and you have a new perspective on it.
Aunt Jessie's hungry. And she's dreaming. She's dreaming about food. 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 Beautiful food. Food. Lettuce. Food. Potatoes.
And then we get the scene you were mentioning earlier, filmed on Tuesday the 19th of September. Another bit I love about this, originally the plan was to film in Shepperton Studios, but amid all the chaos, nobody bothered booking it. So they headed to West Walling Air Station, where filming will take place for another 5 days. But this is Jessie's dream, another incredibly memorable scene. The spaghetti was provided by George Cook. He was the caterer, and he had to cook huge vats of the stuff using a pitchfork to shovel it out. But I think, again, Monty Python, there's some definite Mr. Creosote vibes going on here.
There's a bunch of different things going on in where that's taking place. Like, there's some scenes, I'm going to try to say this in a very subtle way. There's some scenes where all of a sudden, some of the women that are in the room suddenly don't have shirts on. They're not naked. They're in their undergarments. And like, that's another thing that I don't think I realized until more recently. And you're sort of wondering like, well, why is that happening? And again, how does that get past the censors? Not that, that's would be like PG rated these days.
Yeah,
but
definitely. They definitely do.
I think it just cuts for a few minutes. You know, it's just like quick.
I don't think the people at the BBC watched all of it. I think they watched up to the Aunt Jessie bit with Ivor Cutler. Thought, oh no, that's a bit rude. And then they just thought, oh, I can't watch anymore. Oh yes, yeah, sod it, we'll just put it out. And this went out. But to be fair, it's not just Mandy Wheat, because she's got the napkin in her cleavage, basically. But you've also got Jolly Jimmy and Mal Evans. They're all topless as well. So it's you don't want to see that on Boxing Day.
Right.
After all that turkey. Incredible scene, yeah. And John obviously said it was a dream, but that's the kind of we can do anything. Yeah, I had a dream last night. Okay, well, we'll make a scene out.
Wake up, Jessie.
Then we get, wake up, Jessie. and the scene where they're in the field, and it's a remote field near Newquay. This is filmed on Thursday, 14th of September, where everybody's clambering into the tiny tent, and then went back to the Atlantic Hotel. And there's another unused scene, which again you write about in the book, but you can see a photo of it in the booklet that comes with the EP, so it's always been there. And it's Nat's Dream, the Nat Jackley. And again, if you've got a copy of the EP, go and have a look. It's the scene that would have happened after Jesse's dream originally. It was obviously cut by the Beatles, I think, before it was written up. But it says in the book, "If I eat any more," says Happy Nat, "I shall fall asleep. Then you'll miss all the magic," warns Saint Nicola. While the waiters scurry away to get the pudding, the band plays a very exciting dance. "I'm no Spanish dancer, but I certainly know my onions," laughs Happy Nat. Up he gets from the table and becomes a famous Spanish bullfighter. After all their eating and all that dancing, no wonder Happy Nat nods off. So while the others tuck into strawberry ice cream or Aunt Mary's apple pie, Happy Nat has a happy dream, all about his adventures with a bunch of pretty girls beside the seaside. You can see this on the outtakes, only John Lennon directed this, and they look freezing.
Right, I know. And again, you wonder, okay, so why was that cut, you know? You don't know why some of these things were done. Yeah, there. I mean, this was September, October, I guess. And it's in, you know, by the seaside in England. It must have been pretty cold, you know. And they're all in bikinis. Some of this stuff is really like it could be the 1950s, girls in bikinis.
Yeah.
It's like that kind of thing. It would be like what you would see in a Dean Martin movie, you know,
yes.
Not in a psychedelic Beatles movie, you know.
Definitely, yeah. Another unused scene, which again you can see, Aunt Jessie playing drums. And again, it's in the EP, the double EP.
Right.
In the cartoon, you can see it's all written up. It would have been in the film. She's fantastic. She's astonishing.
Yeah, she's a real drummer. I mean, she's obviously, you know, there are so many of these things in all the films that are either in the scripts or not in the scripts, in the films, not in the films. These booklets that you know, the novelizations, I guess they're called, you know, they're written before the film is done. And there's stuff in those books that are not in the films. And yeah, in the kind of cartoons and stories that come in the Magical Mystery Tour, the packages, there are things that don't line up.
Yeah.
Because they've got to create these things far in advance. So everything comes out at the same time. So it's interesting to sort of look at the differences of like what happened and that didn't come out on the films. I mean, obviously some of it is just a time thing. They want to make this thing a certain amount of time.
Yeah. And on the same day they were filming this, George had his denim jacket stolen from the bus. But apparently he was given it, or he was lent it by one of the passengers. So, you know, George, play fair. And in the evening, this is the night where Paul, Ringo, Neil and others went to the pub in Perranporth and got drunk with Spencer Davis. And apparently Paul was playing, this is so very Paul, he was playing the piano and having a sing-along till 2 a.m. in the morning before they left. Oh, imagine that. Again, just this random pub.
I know. Yeah, I know. It's incredible. And what's interesting is that Steve Winwood was in Spencer Davis' group, and then obviously he went on to be in Traffic, and they filmed Traffic playing the song "Here We Go Around the Mulberry Bush," yeah, which was supposed to be in the film, and for whatever reason was cut. That would have been great. So now obviously there's a movie that gets eventually made, "Here We Go Around the Mulberry Bush," and Traffic and the Spencer Davis group provide soundtrack, yeah, music, and the writer of that film is Hunter Davies,
yes,
which is interesting.
Yeah.
These connections are amazing.
Turn around every way, looking back another day. The race is on, I'm out to win. Before I start, I must begin. Feeling around, nowhere. This one let me see if I'm lonely.
Again, that film was on the Blu-ray as well. Yeah, it's great. It doesn't kind of make any sense. I wondered, because they're sort of standing on the hill with this giant orb of the Earth. which says sort of walking around like pagans and then spinning it down the hill. I wonder if the beginning, because it's very like cloudy and foggy, I wonder if that scene was meant to go after flying with the clouds.
Interesting. I never thought about that. Huh?
Possible. What the relevance would be, I have no idea, but...
I don't know.
There's no relevance to anything anyway, so...
No, it's all irrelevant.
Hello! Here we are again! Everybody up at Mickey Mouse's!
Come in to play! From Friday the 22nd of September, the tent into the cinema, where they watch Jolly Jimmy performing before we get to see Blue Jay Way. Blue Jay Way sequence filmed on the 21st of September. He wasn't feeling the best of health. The next day he was off with flu. And I'm possibly thinking the fact he was sitting down on the pavement for how many hours surrounded by smoke machines probably didn't help. But this is another very powerful moment in the film.
Oh, yeah. I think for a lot of people, that's one of their favorite. A number of years ago at a local cinema, they did like an evening of clips of the Beatles, like some of the promotional clips. But they played some of the set pieces from the film. And they had that sequence as part of it. And when that comes on, first starts, like you could hear people in the movie theater that night. There was like this, this hush of like, oh, wow. It's like, what is cooler than George Harrison in the Blue Jay Way sequence from Magical Mystery Tour?
Very much so. And it was also the last thing that they filmed, the little scenes around Ringo's house, where you see him running around with the ball and setting off the fireworks. Because the fireworks, I think it was the 3rd of November, so it had been 2 days before Guy Fawkes Day, hence they had fireworks. And that's fantastic. Another favourite is playing the cello, where they're all playing the cello, especially John.
Yes, definitely.
Ooh, talk about your magical mysteries. I spent half an hour looking for that sugar.
Back on the bus. Oh, yeah, they get back on the bus, which immediately runs over the tent that they've climbed out of. And then back to the magicians. John's being very camp, talking about spent half an hour looking for the sugar. Mal gets a brief moment of singing. And then on the bus, drinking brown ale and Shirley Evans, again, where they're going through the old toot 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 see when Irish eyes are smiling. Ringo looks absolutely pissed.
I'm joined, Ian. What's the matter with you? Hey!
I love that sequence. It's fun because it's a throwback. I mean, it's, again, you know, Sgt. Pepper is looked at as this is the quintessential 60s psychedelic album. But I mean, I think one of the reasons why it's stood the test of time is there is a lot of music on there that is very much a throwback to English music hall or other sort of styles that you wouldn't call rock or rock and roll. Like the mixing. I mean, this is one of the things that I think the Beatles were great at, was borrowing from things from the past and then adding their own special sauce and creating something totally different and new.
Definitely. As a kid, I remember a piano in the pub, and these were exactly the songs they were doing, you know, when Red Red Robin comes bobbing and all that sort of thing. It's a very working class, I would say, thing.
Right.
So maybe that's what, you know, a lot of the BBC viewers at the time wouldn't have liked that, perhaps. Who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, Shirley Evans, she played the accordion with the Norrie Paramore Orchestra, and she later backed Cliff Richard in the 1968 Eurovision Song Contest when he came second with Congratulations. And before her death in 2010, she'd written a book called The Beatles and Me and Shirley's Wild Accordion, which to this day remains unpublished. So there's any publishers out there, make it happen, please.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah.
And while they're doing that, yeah, you've got the scene with George Clayden and Paul on the bicycle on Porth Beach in Newquay. It's from the 13th of September. And then a jolly evening with Jolly Jimmy. It's Death Clap for Cutie.
Well, that night, Cutie called a cab.
Baby, don't do it.
She left her east side room so drab.
Baby, don't do it.
She went out on the town. No one will make her love a frown.
Death Cab for Cutie.
Filmed in Monday the 18th of September. Early start, 6 a.m. The Beatles and the male passengers arrive to the Raymond Review strip club in Soho, where the resident striptease artist Jan Carson did her thing while the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band performed their song. This is, again, very memorable.
That's a great scene. They're just great. I love them. So, I mean, that's them at their prime. It's so like, I'm sure that a young Brian Ferry must have seen that clip and may have gotten a few ideas. I mean, you could definitely trace the sort of line to the, you know, again, it's very much like a throwback to some other era, but here they are creating something that seems at the time so far out and weird, but it really is it's very much a throwback. Okay. And just that whole scene, that could be in a Dean Martin movie. So there are so many different moods in this film. It really is kind of all over the place. It isn't just this trippy psychedelic movie. There's so many different sort of things going on in it.
Yeah. Apparently Viv Stanchel didn't like wearing the chiffon scarf that Paul made him put on. There we go. Two different versions of the auditioning process. According to Tony Bramwell, he says he was given the job of auditioning the strippers, which he says took him 2 days. I mean, you know, come on.
Poor Tony.
I don't know. He said, we narrowed it down to one, Jan Carson. I got her to repeatedly strip while the Bonzos played Death Cab for Cutie over and over again in camp impersonations of Elvis dressed in silver sequin suits. However, according to Alistair Taylor, he chose Jan Carson because she was, quote, a dear friend of mine. So I think Alistair's is possibly more reliable. But it was, Paul Fox was the then controller at the BBC, and he admits that nobody really watched a preview before it was broadcast, save a cursory look by one of his assistants. And that would have been a big thing, BBC, on Boxing Day in 1967. Yeah. It would have been a huge thing. I would think so.
Yeah. You can imagine. I mean, I'm sure the Beatles must have thought that aspect of it was funny, that some of this stuff actually made its way onto television at that point. You wonder if any of it was censored or changed. I don't remember coming across this when I did my research, but maybe I missed it. You just wonder if any of this stuff was changed once they rebroadcast it in color on a different BBC channel.
Yes. Because I'm just thinking on I Am the Walrus, when he says, let your knickers down. There's a flash screen of Jan Carson's knickers. I can't believe I just said that. And it's there. But the censors would have missed that because it's one
right,
second.
For sure. For sure.
So they were playing
it. For sure.
Let's all get up and dance to a song that was a hit before your mother was born. Though she was born a long, long time ago, your mother should know.
Your mother should know.
Then we're straight into a sequence filmed on Sunday, the 24th of September, the finale, Your Mother Should Know.
Again, another fantastic sequence. And I know that there was some sort of technical problem and they had to stop filming. And John very quickly said, we're going to lose all these people. Like, we better like entertain these people, like give them autographs, whatever they want. Let's get out there and let's do this or we're going to lose it, because that was a lot of people in that sequence. And it's a great closer. It really is. And again, a throwback very much to old musicals, almost more Hollywood musicals. So again, there's this constant sort of taking from the past and then spinning it and creating something entirely new.
Yeah, because Peggy Spencer, who choreographed the dancers, apparently she was originally contacted by Paul, who said he'd had a dream about this scene and could she set it up. He said it's a waltz. So she choreographed all the dancers and taught them how to do a waltz. And when she arrived, they had a battered old tape recorder. That's not a waltz. It's not 3/4. So she had to retrain all the dancers. But yeah, the technical thing, they had a generator which blew. It took 5 hours to get another generator in because all the lights had gone out. And yeah, apparently by then the dancers were getting a bit pissed off. So I think, yeah, John did the right thing there.
Yeah.
And also filmed on this day was an unused scene, Ivor Cutler.
I'm going afield, beside the grass. I lie beside the green grass.
Which, again, is a lovely part of the film. Really moving, I find.
You just don't know why some of the... I mean, maybe it's just a time thing. You know, it's interesting, like, if they had done it as a feature film, as an 80, 90-minute feature film, yeah, how different would it have been? What other things, you know, would have stayed in? What things would have maybe been added that were in their minds but never happened, never filmed?
Oh, I'd watch that. Again, Apple, if you're listening, do it. And then, yeah, it ends in a brief reprise of Magical Mystery Tour, followed by the current single, Hello Goodbye. You forget, they released this double EP, this film, and they got a number one single with a completely different song.
I mean, this is really kind of the peak. You know, Rubber Soul, Revolver, Sgt. Pepper, All You Need Is Love, I Am the Walrus. Hello Goodbye almost sounds like they went back to 65.
Yes.
It almost has that, like... You forget when you hear it on the radio, you don't think of it as when it actually was. It sounds more like Ticket to Ride in that period. It's kind of interesting. So it makes for the you know, 12-inch vinyl Magical Mystery Tour album is a little treasure. It is wonderful to have with the booklet and all the photographs, and it's such a great collection of songs. It's not conceived as an album, obviously, by the Beatles. But it really does work. It's the one thing that Capitol in America did that did work, as opposed to the way that previous albums were sort of sliced and diced and you know, refigured.
Yeah, they really did. And I think, although they did mess around with the track sequencing compared to the EP, but again, that would have been timings, I think, for the EP. That suggests, you know, the quality of the music, because it's the same format they did for the other albums. They just grabbed, oh, what else have they done? But the quality of the stuff that they had out there, B-side, is astonishing. You know, Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane, All You Need Is Love. They had a lot of songs.
It's amazing. It's very much just like a continuation of Sgt. Pepper. And the cover, too, the album art, and the pictures of them as the walrus and the other animals on the cover and everything. It's just, it's a riot. It really is truly a riot.
It really is. So, Steve Mateo, what does this film mean to you?
You know, I first saw it as like on one of these midnight movie theater shows. Well, that was the first time I saw it. So it's this thing, you know, that's like, you don't know what's coming, more or less. It's like, whoa, what was that? So it's a little, it takes more viewings to really kind of understand it. When I first saw it, I was probably not as sophisticated in my understanding of the Beatles in the 60s. To put it into context, you're just sort of used to watching, you know, regular sort of linear films at that point. And I mean, I love the soundtrack. Every time I see it, it's just like, it's fresh and new to me, you know, and you really do reevaluate it. You really kind of, it continues to grow in my estimation in terms of what I think about it.
Steve, thank you so much, and good luck with the book.
Thank you.